Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Root Horror Podcast. I'm your host, Marcus. And today's topic will be another Indiegogo campaign crowdfunding episode with director James Dean. James Dean has worked on films Fontaine and The Vengeful Nun That Wouldn't Die. Did I get the title right?
Very close.
Kind of a tongue twister.
Yeah.
He'll be talking about his new film XXXmas, that is a horror comedy, starring indie horror royalty. I consider Drew Marvick, Jessa Flux, Morgan Thompson. And then newly announced Felissa Rose, I was shocked to see.
I'm so excited. Just jumping into the cast about it, and it's not, those are the names that you're aware of and you know, but we've actually made two films. We have a second film that's in post-production right now. So I've worked with a lot of actors that are local to St. Louis, and wow, the amount of talent that is out there and sometimes just needs to be in the right role, or maybe just needs a little bit of direction, just given an opportunity sometimes, it's amazing. So in addition to them, we have people that I've worked with a handful of times before. Jonathan May is a stand-up comedian and he's local, and he is genuinely one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. And he's playing one of the leads. And we have Sean Scott, who's in it, and he's legitimately won world records for weightlifting, and he's done he's a fucking MMA fight coming up in a month here locally. If you look at you the wrong way, you fall over and you submit, but damn. We have such a talented cast, and there's so many more that I haven't even mentioned, and there's a few that I haven't even announced yet. That I'm so pumped about this project, man. Just the talent around me, that alone just gets me buzzing, and talking to them about the project and how excited they are. It's contagious. It builds and builds, and it's phenomenal. It's awesome,
Right. Yeah. And just the concept alone, a Christmas themed horror film is always a fun subgenre to work on, but then, intertwining the adult movie business,
right,
with a blood splattering horror comedy. I think it's mostly going to be a horror comedy, right? Or is it going to be more of a serious?
It's definitely skewing more the horror direction. My general approach to doing anything, if you're approaching a B film or something comedic in a film, I think the best way to approach it, my opinion, is to approach it seriously, but make the dialogue funny or make the moment funny through not trying to purposely be laugh track. Oh, this is the part you're supposed to laugh at, but making the dialogue funny, making the interactions between, when you have a comedian on set, I'm telling you, you don't even have to try, and they will make things funny sometimes, I think that goes a long way. I think when you're trying to purposefully make a B movie, I think it shows and often doesn't hit the mark because people are like, oh, I see what they're doing there. I'd rather them not know what I'm doing. And then I hit them and they're like, that was actually pretty fucking funny. I wasn't expecting that,
Right.
I'd be lying if I didn't say that Santa has some one-liners, after a few kills. Yeah. I want to make it it's a horror film, but I want to have those one-liners, definitely. I mean, that's what made some of these iconic slashers who they are, even after Freddy got super silly, right? Even before that, rather, he had one-liners, they took the cheese to a level that was probably unneeded once you get past a certain point. But I don't know. I love the combination of everything and it working kind of in tandem.
Right. Yeah. Freddy, the later Nightmare on Elm Street entries is a good example of that. But even talking a little bit earlier, it got me thinking of like Return of the Living Dead, like that type of humor where, you know, the movie is, you know, for the most part, they're trying to take, you know, it's trying to be serious, but it's almost like, you know, there's some comedic moments in there that's unintentional, but yet, you know, there's just those humor elements to the horror film.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so, is that sort of what you're getting at with this film?
It definitely is. A couple of my favorite films that I'll continue to talk about over and over, and we're not going for these exact feels, so just keep that in mind in advance. But a couple of my favorite films are Evil Dead 2. And again, that steps into like Three Stooges territory, and I'm not going for that, but I still absolutely love that film, and I love the gore and blood in that. And I'm a huge fan of splatstick in general, like over the top gore that like makes me smile, you know, when it's practical. Yeah. I mean, and then, Dead Alive, Peter Jackson's Dead Alive. It's also known as Brain Dead. Yeah. Right. I'm always
perfect.
Yes. I love so much about that. And like, if you watch the film, there's never like those ha ha moments. I mean, there are, but it's not written as a joke. It's played seriously, but it's so over the top that it's funny. I mean, it is funny, you know.
Oh yeah. Lionel at the park with the baby fighting while like everyone's looking at them. I mean, and he's you know, it's a serious scene, but I mean, you know, moments
you
like
can't
that
help
is
but
so
laugh.
Over the top.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so wild. If you actually if you look at the painting right here, it's a family portrait of three different zombies. It's the baby from Dead Alive. It's Dr. Tongue as the father from Day of the Dead. And then it's I can never remember her name when I'm trying to like talk about her, but it's Return of the Living Dead Part 3, the girl with the piercings and all the cuts. She self-cuts and because she's trying to like not keep the hunger away. So I had a
Julie,
friend actually
if
make
I remember
me
right.
That's right. Yeah. I had someone make me a family portrait of zombies from different films, and so yeah, of course the baby had to be in there.
That's awesome, man. And all three of those films are great, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, like, see, it's so hard coming on a podcast and talking about my film, because then I want to get sidetracked and talk about other horror films.
That's fine. We have like an hour or so. So
yeah, for sure. but like to have Dr. Tongue show up and be in the film for 4 seconds, 5 seconds, maybe during the intro, and then have such a lasting impact as a zombie that doesn't even show up again, you know, that's so crazy to me that you make one little moment with a character, not even really a character, it's a zombie, you know, and then it's forever lasting. You know, I'm sitting here asking someone to paint me do a painting for me, you know, almost 40 years later. That's wild, right. You know.
Yeah. I mean, characters like that don't have a lot of screen time. They have a, you know, their first impression and is just, you know, it's very memorable. And, you know, those are the type of character we remember for years and years and so forth, which, yeah, that's crazy that, you know, someone with maybe 5 seconds of screen time has such an impact on the viewers that watch the films.
Right. It's funny. I actually have a model kit that I commissioned someone to put together and airbrush for me. And I've had that for 15 years now. And because I definitely cannot paint or do airbrush or anything of that extent, but I love the idea behind it. I love the process behind it. And so I have, you know, and it's of Dr. Tongue. That was the very first one I purchased was Dr. Tongue. So made a huge impact on me for sure. You were talking about, kind of like the idea behind Triple Xmas. And when it came to me, I actually had not seen Ty West's new film yet, X. I knew about it, of course. I knew that he had made a film about a horror film about the porn industry in the 70s. But I've always loved holiday-themed horror, like Christmas horror, you know? But I feel like there's been a huge influx of everyone doing something to that extent. And I wanted to make something original about it. And I didn't just want to make it the same thing. And this was before I even realized that, I mean, I had heard of Violent Night when I started working on this project, but I had not heard of Christmas Bloody Christmas, Joe Bagos' film. So, like, I saw them come out, and then I started digging as we got more and more into pre-production. I realized how many indie films had already been made about Christmas horror, and I was really shocked. So I'm glad that we can stand apart with a couple things, and you'd kind of already mentioned it, but making it a film where it's Santa Claus having a breakdown, which is explained in the story. I just don't know if I want to like get too much into that because it involves a lot of spoilers, but Santa Claus having a breakdown and then deciding to target porn stars on a Christmas themed porn shoot. You know, like I was honestly shocked that no one has ever capitalized on that name, XXXmas. You know, it blew me away. I searched Google and IMDb and I was like, I don't feel like I'm that original, you know? So I was like very pleased with myself, which is not something that happens very often either. And well, that's where it kind of started, you know, like So.
Well, I wanted to kind of add that to that because, you know, in more recent years, you know, the indie community is really stepping up their game as far as, you know, making horror films. And, you know, you would think that these bigger budget studios would capitalize on these names or ideas, and they haven't, because they don't want to put the money into making the films. But yet, you know, the power is in the indie filmmakers' hands, and, you know, the indie filmmakers are the ones and the producers and everybody that works within the indie horror community. You know, they're putting in the work and they're making all of these ideas come to life that, you know, the bigger studio budget filmmakers wouldn't want to touch.
I agree. Sometimes I'm shocked when certain movies are made that they're made because I feel like studios want to avoid, they want to go with the safe choice often, I feel like. And there's very few directors that I think get a pass on, they can make whatever they want to make. And they are directors that have been in the industry for 30 years. We're talking, you know, Spielberg and Cameron and like people that have such a great track record, and you know, they kind of dictate what they want to make, you know, and that's understandable. I guess a more recent example would be the Daniels, Daniel Kwan, and I can't remember the other guy's name, that made Everything Everywhere All at Once. That's a pretty wild concept film. It's amazing, in my opinion, but like on paper, the way that plays out, I can't imagine most studios being like, yeah, I don't feel like they were probably super excited about it. Like the fact that that movie got made surprises me in a lot of ways. I think there's a lot of benefit to being an indie filmmaker, a lot of things that you can capitalize on that you can't if you have a studio or a large backer with money who constantly wants to have their finger on the production and constantly wants to have a say in everything that should be done a certain way. You know, the freedom comes in that, one, you're limited in a lot of ways, obviously. Budget and time is huge, but you're not limited in what you want to show and how you want to show it. You know, I mean, there are going to be some limitations. You can't have, you're not going to show like real pornographic material or excessive nudity or violence to a degree where, you know, like a lot of streaming services just aren't going to pick it up. There are limitations, you know, you have to be realistic. But even then, I've seen filmmakers who have went and made things that are over that line, which is kind of an imaginary line of sorts, and they just sell it as physical media at cons. So like there is a path forward for everybody, and everybody's indie film path, I think, is so different, you know, like it's
right.
I think it varies from filmmaker to filmmaker and from movie to movie, believe it or not, you know, unless you're making the same kinds of movies over and over, which is fine also.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think like with indie filmmakers and people that just, you know, want to be a part of indie horror films, like there's more of like creative freedom to do what you want. Like you're not limited to, you know, A, B, C, D is what you have to do. You're more like, well, I can mix it up. I can do, you know, I can go out of order. I can do, you know, whatever I want to do, because this is my film, like, you know, this is my creative domain to where there is no limitations.
Yeah, I completely agree. And even using unconventional storytelling, which is kind of, I think, what you're alluding to, with the exception of, I'm probably going to missay the name, but is it Skinamarink? Is that the new movie that came out? I heard that's creating
a lot of buzz.
I heard that's very unconventional. It sounds very, I want to see it. If I get a chance, I'll see it in theaters. I've already heard the things that are turning people off. That's not going to bother me. I understand that it's more of an experience and less of a conventional movie with, you know, a regular 90-minute runtime. And, you know, like I heard, you don't see the main actors' faces at all in the film. Okay. I know that going in now. I know that it almost sounds like to me, that demo that got pulled up called PT. It was like a Silent Hill prequel test, I guess, that was on Sony PlayStation about 5-6 years ago. It sounds creepy as fuck, and it sounds like that, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I
mean, I've only just heard a little bit about it. I honestly haven't heard much about it, but I know that it's creating a lot of buzz. People are saying that, you know, it's awesome. Check it out. So...
I think it cost $15,000 and it ended up making almost, I think, $800,000 this last weekend. At, you know, that's incredible.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Yeah. For more or less like an indie horror film.
Yeah. Especially something that's so unconventional with its storytelling, you know, from what I've heard, it's very much like a dream, like a film where you're almost watching or experiencing a dream, you know, and that's not going to resonate with everybody. You know, you look at filmmakers like Fulci, and some people just cannot get behind Fulci. Like, and I think it's the way he approaches his story, the way he approached his storytelling, you know, it's so dreamy, but almost like you're kind of in and out of a nightmare at times. And there's like this, I don't know. It's, I can't even quite put my finger on it with him, but he doesn't work for everybody. I love his stuff, you know? But a lot of people are, it can be polarizing, but you know, again, it's a very specific approach to telling a story. And I love when a filmmaker or any artist is allowed to do it the way that they're wanting to, you know, it feels more pure. It feels more real, you know, authentic.
Right. Right. And to me, like there was always almost like, like not with all of his films, but some of them just more like a raw feel. Like this was totally his film and he made everything how he wanted it. He didn't really care about, you know, the big budget studio behind him or, you know, I don't even know if you know, what kind of, you know, studio over in Italy that they were working for. But it is, you know, his films totally felt like, you know, this was his vision and there was no one behind him to pull the string, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, you're always just, like I said, especially when you have people backing you with money and especially when they have certain titles or, you know, once they start becoming involved, they're going to have a say. And I absolutely love collaboration. I think every project I've ever had has greatly benefited because of collaboration. I have things in my head a certain way, but when I talk to my DP, I've had two DPs now, and the one that for this new film, he was a co-DP on my last film that's in post-production right now. And even with my first DP, I will approach them with storyboards and shot ideas, and then they'll come back and we'll kind of talk about it. And then they may have an alternate idea, or they may have kind of a little bit of a shifting opinion on it where it's what I want, but it's slightly different. And you know, there's very few times where I've said, no, I don't want to do that. And usually there's a very specific reason. If a shot doesn't convey an emotion or if it's kind of just off a little bit, but the idea of collaboration, working with actors, the same thing. If you just expect someone to come in and line read for you, you're not letting an artist do their art, you know? And that's what actors want to do. They want to be artists also. They don't want to come in and just be super strict. And every time I've ever collaborated with someone, they always bring something that I wasn't expecting. They always give life to a character in ways that I didn't even think about because I was so busy looking at the big picture. You spend time with these characters, but not as much as an actor does when they're trying to bring it to life, you know? From a director's right. point of view, you're looking at the story, you're looking at character arcs, you're looking at characters' motivations. But when you have an actor that's playing one character, they're thinking about that one character only for the most part, you know? And it's, I love it. Like, collaboration is amazing. Different when it's someone in an office building that doesn't even know what you're trying to accomplish. And they just sent you, you know, a check for $1 million. And I say just like it's nothing. Like, $1 million check to make a movie would be awesome. But
most definitely.
The feedback from them may not be, you know.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, Triple Xmas.
Yeah.
I know, like, just looking at a perspective of when people just see the title and stuff like that, they automatically think like, oh, this is a adult, you know, like a porno.
There's been some confusion for sure. And I've been very, very adamant about being clear that, you know, this is not a porno. Yeah. There's going to be nudity. Of course there's going to be nudity. One, it's a tribute to like 80s slasher films, which always had nudity. Two, it's on a set of a porno. I mean, like, yeah, there's going to be nudity, but we're not shooting a porno, you know? And if we were, that would be fine too, but I probably wouldn't be going to Indiegogo for funding for it, to be honest with you.
Right. Right. Yeah. That would be, you know, I wouldn't say odd, but I mean, I think you'd probably be the first person to try to do an Indiegogo campaign on a porno.
Probably. I don't know. You know, the interesting thing is, and I was talking to someone who's acting in the movie, and he has his own podcast and his own YouTube show. And we were talking about, so one thing that like I've said, but I don't always lead with, and I'd like to talk about a little bit, is this is a tribute to like 80s horror film. There's going to be gore and it's going to be a slasher feel, but there's also a commentary on sex workers and the way society makes use of the services of sex workers all the time. If you look up what's the most Googled website, like Pornhub is one of the biggest ones, you know, yet there's also this huge stigma that comes with it and people acting like someone that's a sex worker isn't doing real work. And that's just bullshit. You know, I mean, it is, you know, so like there's an underlying subtext, and I don't like being too heavy-handed with these kinds of things. I don't want the movie to be like punching a person in the face when they're watching it, saying, you know, you have to think like this, you have to believe like me. I don't like that. I never liked that. But I do love films where there's a subtext, and the subtext of this film is there's a lot of people who discount and dehumanize sex workers, and there's a stigma around it. And there shouldn't be. And I hope one day there isn't, you know, and that's kind of an underlying message. And in some ways, even motivations behind some of the characters' actions. And I'll leave it at that. I don't want to give like any wild spoilers away. But yeah, it's going to be fun. We're hoping to actually partner with a charity for sex workers' rights. We've reached out to a handful. Sometimes it takes a while to hear back from charities. We partnered with the Trevor Project when we did our first film, Fontaine and the Vengeful Nun Who Wouldn't Die. You know, and we did okay. We raised like $250 for them. It wasn't much, but hopefully with each film, we're able to do more and more with these charities we're working with. And we can bring light to some of these more serious issues outside of just a, you know, a crazy killer Santa film, you know, like why not do both? You know, I love the idea of maybe being able to do some good through creating something that like is the most obscene idea ever, you know, Santa, the real Santa, not some guy in a Santa suit. This is the real Santa, you know, losing his shit and attacking a bunch of porn stars. That's pretty,
because you know, they've been naughty.
Yes, exactly. it's a very far-fetched idea. Like, you know, let's not, you know, it's out there for sure, but I love that also because it's something new. And when I saw that no one had ever thought of it, I was like, like I was telling you earlier, I was really shocked. I would have thought someone would have capitalized on this by now.
Right. Yeah. Like when I, came across, you know, even before like you reached out to me to do like a podcast, I had seen your campaign before. So, you know, and that caught my eye of like, wow, like how has no one ever thought of that before? Like the concept just it's one of those like lightning in a bottle moments where it's like, you know, this is something that you would have already thought had been made, but
right.
It hasn't been made. And, you know, you're putting in the work to make sure that this film is going to get made. So I think that's awesome, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so excited to be a part of it, man. Like it's wild. And like, I haven't even talked about half the cast involved or, you know, but like talking about like original ideas and things, something that a lot of people probably aren't fans of, but nunsploitation, our first film, it's nunsploitation essentially, you know? And like, there's not a whole lot of those kinds of films being made now. So when I made that, it took us forever to make it, you know, this is going to be a way quicker production. But when we made it, we were really still learning how to make films. And so I'll always love the film, but it also, it shows there's a couple instances where I wish we could have done things a little bit differently, but I love all the tributes to different films. And I've had some people recognize some of the tributes and some not. A lot of people don't even recognize the little moments because they're not related to nunsploitation. You know, there's a moment where a nun has her arm cut off and the blood spray is a direct reference to Tenebrae. And I don't think anyone has ever mentioned that to me, maybe one person. And I kind of like that because I'd rather, it's a reference on purpose, of course, but you know, like I love the idea that it's not so clearly staged to replicate something that someone did before that is a master of the craft. And here I am, some guy in St. Louis trying to recreate it. It's not going to be the same. I'm not going to do the level, you know, I'm not Argento, I mean, like it's not going to happen, you know? I feel like that's a downfall some filmmakers get into when they're trying to pay tribute to another filmmaker or something they've seen before, is they try to recreate it exactly. And you know, you're just not, there's a reason why they are who they are. They're amazing. And there's a reason, you know, they've been around for years and years and everyone loves their work. When you try to recreate it, it's not going to happen. And no one's going to love it or see it probably more than likely, like they saw the other person's, you know? So take it, maybe use it as a reference point, a jumping off point, and use it for inspiration to maybe do something slightly similar, but just different enough that you can tell your story with a piece of art that they created and in a similar fashion. You know, like I love that. I love taking inspiration from other artists, you know,
right.
It's fun. It's fun to me, especially when I'm not just copying it and using it in the same exact way they did, you know?
Right. Well, like look at, I know this is kind of a mainstream pick, but like, you know, the Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino's Grindhouse.
Yeah.
You know, they used so many references to, you know, the 70s Grindhouse films, and
sure,
you know, it definitely worked. Like just, you know, all the Grindhouse tropes they threw in that film, and you know, it was a hit, especially with the horror fans.
Yeah.
And exploitation fans.
Yeah. I absolutely love that movie. And I loved watching it as a double feature. I think I saw it like three times in theaters. I don't think it did very well in theaters, but I absolutely loved going to see it on a big screen in a double feature where you only had to pay for really one, you know, you only had to pay for one movie, but you really got two, you know?
Oh yeah. And then, you know, even the fake movie trailers
were
just amazing. And then, you know, Eli Roth just announced that he's finally going to make the full length Thanksgiving film that everyone has been begging him to make.
For how long? I mean, isn't Grindhouse like a 15-year-old? I feel like it's like at least 12 or 15.
2007?
15 years.
Is when that came out?
15 years. Yeah,
15 years. Holy shit.
Yeah. And I would love to see Rob Zombie cast Nick Cage as Fu Manchu also. Like, I'm down. You know, bring me a Werewolf Women of the SS. I'm 100% behind that.
Right. I mean, all of them, dude. I was down to watch all of them. Even Edgar Wright's Don't.
Oh, like, yeah.
Don't.
Yeah.
The door. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't open the door. You know, all those little tropes in there is awesome.
Yeah, for sure. So I keep getting diverted away from Triple Xmas, but you know, like the Indiegogo we're running, we have, you know, as far as like the perks and the things that you can, like ways you can support us, we have everything from posters for super inexpensive for like $20, you know, Blu-rays, you can become an associate producer. I've had people come on who did not know me, who I had asked to help maybe run an article. And I just talked to someone yesterday who he said, well, we may not be able to get it in time, but I just supported the campaign. And I wasn't even asking him to support the campaign. And I got the email and I was thinking, okay, the guy probably went and bought a Blu-ray. He came on as an executive producer and put $1,300 towards the campaign. I don't know this guy at all.
Oh my God.
You know, he'd watched our first film, and that's actually how we started talking, is as like, hey, I appreciate you watching the film and I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you found something that was enjoyable in the film. And I was like, hey, I noticed you run this website. Is there any chance you could get an article out before the expiration of this, you know, of our campaign? And he looked at the campaign and didn't, it just blows me away. Something like that. Like, I don't know this guy from anything. I'd say at least half of the people that have contributed, probably 70%, almost three quarters, I don't even know them, you know? And that's so awesome, you know, to think that people, right. I mean, like sometimes they're contributing because of other people involved with the project, you know, like Felissa Rose or Drew Marvick or Jessa or Morgan or, you know, Dolly Lee's in the film. I don't think I mentioned her earlier. I should have. She has real world experience in the porn industry, you know? So having her a part of the film was really nice in that. I mean, like a lot of the people involved have sex work experience or in some cases are still sex workers, and having them involved and having their feedback on the script was super important to us. You know, again, it's a Killer Santa film, so we're not trying to go super highbrow here, but I wanted to make sure that we were depicting these people as real human beings first, and not some caricature of what people think, you know, actors in the porn industry are, you know? Right. There's already enough stigma around that. I don't need to add to it. And I don't know. I'm not a sex worker. I mean, obviously look at me, but I don't do that. So like my experience is limited to what I think about it. There's no real world experience like informing that. So of course I was going to ask for their feedback. You know, I did the same thing. When I co-wrote Fontaine, the character's a gay nun, right? I grew up Catholic, so I had the Catholic thing down. I understood that. But like, I'm not gay. So I reached out to friends that were gay and bisexual and trans, and I got feedback from them. Just wanted to make sure I wasn't doing anything that was like clearly weird or like out of character or something that, you know,
right. Should I make things more authentic?
For sure. And this may, so something that I try to do when I write is I don't approach things from, oh, you know, like if I'm writing Marcus, I don't say, oh, well, I'm writing Marcus. He has a beard and he has a flannel shirt on. So obviously he's a lumberjack. No, I don't do it that way. I look at you and I'm like, well, you're a human being, right? No, seriously, I look at it and I'm like, you're a human being. I'm a human being. How can we relate? We both have feelings and we both have, and you can build a character out that way, just from the human perspective. You don't have to take certain things into account right off the bat when you're writing a character. But eventually you do, you know, like your experiences and, you know, your background and your culture and what religious upbringing, all that stuff does come into play. And if I don't have a background similar, I'd be an asshole if I don't like at least consult with someone who does, you know?
Right. Right. For sure. Yeah. I totally get that concept of writing a character. You would hate to depict someone portraying like either a cultural background or ethnicity that might turn people the other way as far as like, yeah, that didn't settle well or
I have a close friend who is in the process and he's been developing a show for a while and he's African-American and part of the show has to do with the individual being alive for hundreds of years. And so it involves with storytelling that has to do with slavery. Right. And I told him that I'd be more than happy to help him with it. I'd even be more than happy to write on the show. But I said, I'm going to tell you right now that if you're thinking I'm going to be a sole writer on a show about someone who was a slave, I said, we're not doing that. I'm not doing that. I said, you know, if you want me in a room of, you know, and and we have four writers and three of them are African-American and I'm the one white dude, I'm fine with that. You know, I can bring something to it. I can help revise the script. There's always things I can add to a script and give my opinion on, but I can't write that story with an authentic viewpoint. You know, I mean, like I can approach it from the human perspective, but I'm going to be missing out on a lot,
right?
You know? And he, you know, of course he completely understood, and we're still kind of toying with the show and working on it. It's any kind of art that's that in depth takes so long to get off the ground and to keep the momentum behind it. It's tough.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. I couldn't even imagine writing a script. I'm trying to write my first one, but it's a lot tougher than I thought.
Yeah.
But then I was also even like trying to write it from like the director's perspective. And I kind of was talking to an author friend of mine and kind of showed him some of my notes. He's like, I think what you're doing is good, but he's like, but if you're not directing it, you don't need all this extra stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. So I think I'm like thinking too much into what I think what a script is and maybe what it actually is.
There's definitely a couple thoughts I would have on that. If you're writing for someone else to direct, be very careful about stage direction or camera movements, you know, because a director wants to be able to do that, you know, and they're going to come along and do what they want anyway. And the other factor, and this has really helped me, is knowing who your characters are like 100% before you start writing. I mean, sometimes characters will surprise you, but having a very strong idea about especially the leads and who they are, then when you start putting them in circumstances, situational events, whatever, if you know that they're this person and they have this set of beliefs, their response will come so much more natural. Even when you're not sure what it is and you're in the moment and you're writing, I feel like, oh, well, you know, someone walked up to this person and is trying to get into a fight with them. Well, this is someone that just in general doesn't back down. Easy. I mean, they're going to punch the guy in the face. They're going to get into an altercation. They don't back down. You know, it's weird how fast those things will come into play and just fall into place when you really know the character. The other writing tip that I would personally give is don't make it perfect on your first pass. Fuck perfection. Just get it down. Just get the ideas out. It's called a vomit draft often, but, and it may even be the worst thing you've ever read. That's okay. If you have it out, then you can go through and refine it on the second pass, the third pass. Maybe the final version is nothing like that, but just having something completed also gives you this feeling of, oh, I just finished the first draft. I feel really good that I got all of this out. I can take a week off, come back to it. I can send it off for notes. You know, like there's a lot of benefits to just getting that first draft out there. You know, I've had things change significantly between the first draft and the third, fourth, fifth draft. You know, I feel like in some way, shape or form, I'm writing until it's released, because even in the edit, you can change depending on what coverage you have. You can change words and phrases sometimes and have someone come in and do ADR. Hollywood does this all the time. If a camera is behind someone's shoulder and they're talking, you don't know that's what they were saying. You know, like when you start noticing these things in films, they start to make way more sense. Like, oh, that may not have been the original line. Maybe that didn't test right. Maybe Disney didn't like how that tested with audiences. So they went back in and just used footage from over the shoulder, not showing the face of the person talking, and they rewrote it. You know, obviously that's not the approach you want to take. You don't want to be in that situation, but sometimes things don't come out the way you want them to. So you can write all the way up until the end. Now, if you're writing and selling the script, once you sell it, it's kind of out of your hands, you know, unless they really want you to be a collaborator on set or a collaborator through the process, which that in general just doesn't happen, I don't think.
Right. Yeah. I think those are very useful advice points as far as writing goes for film or script. I'll definitely try to utilize some of the information that you gave me.
It's wild in the 2 years that we've had. So I do a podcast, which I've talked about a little bit, the Film Hacks, where we interview filmmakers. And we've had mostly try to concentrate on indie and micro budget filmmakers, definitely films that are typically under $100,000. We've had a few filmmakers who've had movies that were in the $4 or $5 million range. And like, it's always interesting to hear everyone's feedback. We've had a couple directors who have done work for Asylum. And it's very interesting to see how Asylum handles. And, you know, you can discount Asylum's work if you want to, but they have a business model. They keep making films because they keep making money and they're paying people to do these things. So even if you don't like their work, it's working for them. You know, you don't have to like it because it's working for them, you know, and there's still things you can learn about their process, even if you don't like the finished product. It's, you know, the one filmmaker who was on, he was telling us that when Asylum gives them a script, it's not even finished most of the time. And sometimes they can create things on the go as they're shooting. But he said there are certain things that are locked in. And the reason they're locked in is that Asylum knows what they want the trailer to be before they ever shoot the first thing they want it to shoot. And there's certain lines that need to line up so they can put it in the trailer. You know, I made my first film and never even thought of that. The trailer was, you know, I knew I had little moments where I liked, and I started making notes on my whiteboard about this is going to lead to this, and I can cut it this way to try to give the audience an idea of what's going on with the story and hopefully entice someone to come watch my film. But I never, from the draft point on, started writing something with the intention of releasing a trailer. You know, like, I didn't think that far ahead. But Asylum's been doing it for 20 years and has all these filmmakers come in, and they know that, you know? So, like, you can take these little pieces from even companies like Asylum and use them in your own movies, you know? Like, you can do that for free. It doesn't cost anything. It's just time, you know, just
right.
Having the know-how. We had Fred Olin Ray on, and like, talking to him was just like, it was so eye-opening. I mean, this dude's made so many cult B movies, and now he's a working director making films for Lifetime, and you know, like, he's working for Lifetime, and he's, you know, he shoots these films.
Who'd have seen that coming? Right.
Right. But you know what? Like, and you know, and like, I'm not, that's not right. Right. I agree with you 100%. It's not necessarily the kind of film that I'm going to rush out to watch, you know, like these thrillers that take place on Lifetime movie or whatever, or the Hallmark Channel. I don't remember which one it was. They all kind of very similar to feel to me. But
right.
The dude's getting paid and he's working and he's still working and he's still making films. And I mean, you know, it's nice to be able to say that your film made a profit, or your film, or you were able to make a film that's making enough that you can go and make another film without working another job 50, 60, 70 hours a week. You know, it's tough trying to do both.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that, like, you know, some directors would be like, just hired just for a job.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes, I mean, that's almost the way to go, just to, you know, I've seen like filmmakers kind of do, films as jobs, just to, as like a stepping point to keep stepping up to, you know, where they actually want to go, and, you know, where their passion films are going to be.
I think that was really common. I think it still happens, but I think it was way more common when like indie film wasn't a thing, when you had to have some sort of studio backing you before like digital cameras became a thing, where filmmakers would do this exchange, like, I'll do one for you and I want you to do one for you. I want you to do something I'm passionate about, you know? And there was like this exchange of, you know, I'm going to make the movie you want, studio, whatever. And then I want you to green light this project I want to make. I think in the 80s and 90s, that happened a lot, you know? And I mean,
yeah, I think that was a real thing.
Yeah. I don't know as much now, because it's so much easier. The point of entry to make a film and to make it look good. Like, it's crazy how many filmmakers are making movies that are, they look and sound really good. And, you know, if you don't make your movie look and sound really good, it's tough to keep people's attention. You better have an angle. You better have something going for you, because there's just so much content and people's attention span is so short nowadays.
Oh, you know, most definitely.
I mean, from a marketing standpoint, I've been told by so many people that know marketing and went to school for marketing, if you have something to say and you want people to hear all of it, 59 seconds. That's what you have. You have 59 seconds. Okay. I mean, a movie's not 59 seconds, so it's kind of you better be able to really have someone's interest in order to keep their attention for 90 minutes or 80 minutes or 2 hours, whatever your runtime is, you know?
Right. Yeah. And man, I think it's really hard to try to come up with something that can keep people's attention. Cause
yeah,
you know, you have social platforms like TikTok now, and you know, like that's the big thing where
yep,
the younger generation, like that's all they want to watch. And you know, some of them clips are, you know, maybe 10 seconds long and then they're off to the next video.
Yeah.
You know, the attention span, you know, again, has just has dwindled down tremendously. But then, you know, you see movies like Megan that just released.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they understood that, you know, that this sort of thing is happening where attention spans are small. So, you know, they're trying to grasp the younger crowd into wanting to watch this film. And, you know, what better way than to, you know, incorporate technology with, you know, the horror aspect of a killer Android doll.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've already greenlit a sequel to it. So, Megan 2.0. They already
have the release date.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Which I was kind of surprised that they have the release date picked out. And I'm just like, Jesus Christ, like the movie's still in theaters and they're already, you know, the first one's still in theaters and they're already trying
I just saw it last weekend. So I mean, well, that's another company that clearly understands, for the most part, they clearly understand the market and they, you know, they have a very polished product at the end, you know, something that, and I'm in the minority here and I 100% understand that. I'm not a huge fan of a lot of modern horror films. And when I say modern, I mean, I think the last 5 years or so. And I think that part of my problem is when you give a movie $10 million and it has a bunch of script issues, I just, you know, you give an indie filmmaker who has 10,000, it has script issues. Yeah. I'd be shocked if it didn't, you know, I mean, it's a $10,000 budget. You have a film with $10 million and it's like, oh, there's all kinds of holes in this. When you look at it, you know, it's like, I don't know. I find myself gravitating more towards older films and indie film these days for sure. And maybe that's because I'm in that arena also. And I want to support my friends and support people that I've learned are filmmakers who are creating something that's new and just interesting, you know, like it goes back to what you were saying about the ideas, you know, like just being you know, this unlimited possibilities of what I'm going to see. I don't know how they're going to approach it. And, you know, there's always, as the thing I find very common with indie filmmakers is that there's always references to stuff that they loved when they were younger, which is fine. You know, it can become derivative, but it's still fine because I'm taking in consideration that they probably had less than $30,000 making this film, you know, and most of the people behind it were just extremely passionate and a lot of times did it for nothing, you know, like that says so much to me versus a movie that had $10 or $20 million budget. You know, I don't know. It's been so hard for me to get behind a lot of the bigger budgeted films lately. And it's actually frustrating me because I want to like these movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have to say, like, I'm very selective when it comes to these newer films. But you know, then again, Ty West has impressed me over the years with some of his earlier films.
Sure.
And, you know, to see him get the, you know, the big budget push with A24 on the X trilogy, which, you know, that's been an amazing trilogy so far. I was very impressed with Pearl. I thought that was an amazing film.
I need to watch Pearl. I just watched X, I guess 2 weeks ago. So I was pretty late to that one too. It was something that I wanted to watch when it came out. There's a long list of movies I want to watch. But I finally got to that and I really enjoyed it. And I think the further I got away from it, as far as time after watching it, I actually even appreciated it more. But everyone has told me that if I liked that one, I'm going to absolutely love Pearl. So it's one that's on my list. And then Maxine, I think, is the next one in the trilogy. And I love Ty West, House of the Devil, right? I think that's the name of it.
Yeah,
I absolutely love that. And then
I think my favorite from him, though. Yeah. I mean, that one's just, it's very hard to beat.
Yeah, I'm with you on that for sure. And then Innkeepers, I think he made.
Yep, the Innkeepers.
Yeah, yeah. I liked it, but like you said, the House of the Devil, I think that's his. That's his shining star at this moment, at least. I have to watch Pearl, right. So maybe my opinion will change on that. But yeah,
right. I don't mean to like stay on the Ty West too long, yeah. But I do want to mention like something that I've noticed with his filmmaking is he perfects these timestamp films.
Yep.
Like, I mean, most of his films they take place in different times. For the most part, and he nails the detail in those time pieces.
Yeah.
I thought he definitely nailed the 80s time piece to House of the Devil, and then like with X, the 70s. I did a pretty good job.
I feel like he understands the nuance behind it and the difference between what those time periods were and how they are often celebrated. And there is a difference, you know, there's memes that go around talking about that all the time, like how people remember the 80s and it has all these neon colors and like all these cool things and gadgets and everything. And then how the 80s really were. And then it shows like the wood paneling and the big box TV that sat on the floor that took three people to pick up, you know, it's like,
right.
Yeah.
Everyone has still had like those 70s, couches.
Oh yeah,
you know, like at like your grandma's or grandma and grandpa's house, like just those old school. You're talking about
the big couches. Wood block ends on them with cushions over it, kind of. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and then like those weird patterns that
the ugly flower pattern. Yes,
yes,
yes, yes. I know what you're talking about. And sometimes, depending on how far you know in the 80s you were. Probably one of those like knitted throws from like Roseanne that was on the back of it, you know, like it just depends on probably where you're located, but we definitely had one of those.
Yep. I remember those too.
Yeah, for sure.
I just think that he nails those time periods, whatever film he decides to make, you know, it's impeccable. And I really appreciate the time and effort that he puts into making sure that everything's authentic and
right and those things take money, you know, like you need a freaking army to make those things, you know. People don't think about how much an art department makes a difference on what's in the background of a frame, you know, like what's on the wall and how that also helps to inform the story and the color palette. All those things have to be tied in. If you don't have the money or the resources for an art department, all that, then the wall's blank and the frame looks like garbage. And there's an opportunity wasted where you could have put a picture of someone that, you know, maybe they dated earlier in their life or someone that is deceased and informs the character was once married. Like there's all kinds of storytelling that can happen without it being verbal, you know, and an art department and wardrobe, especially with something time specific, era specific, dude, you're not going to, you know, it's not possible without money. And it just really isn't. Right. Or a bunch of free help. And I don't mean like one or two people. I mean, an army of people. look at the list of people in the credits of his films and how many are in the art department. He probably has 10 people, you know?
Oh that, yeah, for sure.
That's typically what we have on set, you know, for the whole crew, you know? So it's like, you know, I mean, yeah, it's tough, but,
for sure.
One thing I would like to bring up before we conclude is, you know, for anyone listening, you know, you don't have to necessarily when it comes to like Indiegogos, you don't have to, if you don't have money or if you don't find something particularly interesting about the film that's running the Indiegogo, you don't have to contribute monetarily. Talking about it and sharing the campaign. And I'm not just talking about my film. I'm not talking about our film. I'm talking about all of them, you know, you know, sharing it and talking about it and continuing to share it, it goes a long way. And again, I'm not just talking about the film we're trying to make. I'm talking about, and that's true with podcast and any kind of art form, you know, sharing it over and over. It, it's only way artists can make a living, or can sometimes even make their art, let alone make a living off of it, you know, is right. by people talking about it and celebrating it. And, you know, if you do have a little bit of extra money and you want to buy a Blu-ray, pre-order a Blu-ray, essentially, you know, our track record's great. When we make a film, we release the film, you know, it will be released. You know, the goal for this one in particular is December of this year. It's a tight time frame, but I know we can do it because there's really very little to no visual effects that are going to be done. It's all practical effects. And that's a huge plus. That's a huge time saver. You know, I edit all my own films, which I love doing. I enjoy doing. So I have control over that part of the process. The only parts that are out of my control are sound design, Foley, which I do hire out for, and it does make a difference on the finished product. And even them, I have people that I have working relationships with now that I know the time frame they can work within. So us releasing the film by December of this next of this year now, geez, 2023, you know, that's our goal. And I think it's something that's very accomplishable, you know? So yeah, take a look at the Indiegogo for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, I like I've said earlier, like the concept and then just even the all-star cast has my attention. So,
yeah.
You know, I can't wait to see what you come up with. And
thank you.
And,
yeah.
You know, and then, you know, seeing how all of these actors and actresses coexist in this holiday themed horror film.
Yeah.
You know, I think the film is going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, if this isn't going to be anything like Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, then I think you're going to be okay.
You know, I didn't why didn't I even think to write Garbage Day in there? I totally should have. Is it two or three? I get confused. I think that's
that one's two.
That's two. Okay. Yeah. Either way, I should have wrote that in. I didn't. But see, that's okay. Not everything has to be a copy of things that you've appreciated.
Right. Three is the one with Moe's. I know it's not his fault, but
no. Okay. I know it's a hospital bed, right? Psychic.
Yep. Yeah. He's got the fishbowl on his head. And then there's a lady that's blind has psychic powers. And
yes. Yes. That's one that I may need to revisit. I don't remember it, but when I say may, it's because I'm not sure if I want to.
it
may just be better in my memories, you know.
probably. Although I just bought the new Vestron collection that has 3, 4, and 5 on there.
Oh, but okay.
I mainly got it for the special features because it's just jam packed full of like interviews and commentaries. So I'm interested to kind of hear some of the stories behind the later entries, because there's a lot of holes that were in the film that just made me wonder, like, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
Making this film.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like a lot of times with stuff like that, it's just that something came up and a decision had to be made, and it may not have ended up being the best decision,
right?
But you know, you're kind of stuck with it at that point. You know, mentioning extras on Blu-rays, that's something that we did with Fontaine, and we're definitely with Triple Xmas. We plan on doing interviews with the cast, and we plan on doing tons of extras. And we actually have someone that's dedicated to being on set just for BTS footage, which is nice because we can cut that together and create more of a behind the scenes feel and, you know, look at it from a perspective of the craft itself, as opposed to just watching the movie. And that will be included on the Blu-rays. It probably won't be included on the DVDs just because of the space requirement. But yeah, we'll definitely be including a lot of that, extra behind the scenes kind of stuff. And I love showing, and some people don't want to see this, but I love showing like the anatomy of a kill, like how the practical effect works. I've always found that fascinating. I love practical effects. I love how the frame lies to you, but also tells you the story. Like, you know, like if you took the camera and put it on the other side, you'd see all how the magic trick works. It's like watching the magician at, you know, to, you know, the bunch of 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds doing his magic trick, but you weren't allowed to go around the back because the second you went around the back of his table, you saw that he was just hiding something from you, and he wasn't, there was no magic involved right. with it. But I love knowing how something works. So like all that's going to be on the, I mean, as much as we can is going to be on the Blu-ray. And so that's kind of nice to be able to have that option of that kill was amazing. How'd they do that? Well, more than likely there'll be something there, at least for some of the kills, to show you how we accomplished it. So yeah, I dig that. Right, I like the extras.
Right on. And I really liked how you brought up the fact that there's going to be practical effects in this film.
Oh yeah.
I'm a big believer in practical effects. So, you know, for a film that's going to be made in 2023, makes me very happy to hear that practical effects and people that are filmmakers appreciate practical effects as well.
A very, very large portion of our budget is set aside for practical effects. And that was always the scenario when I budgeted it out. You know, a little over 30% of the budget is going towards practical effects. That's a lot of the budget, you know. It's expensive, man. It is. But I'd rather... You know, also it comes into like just being able to know I can make those deadlines. If I have to wait for one more person in the pipeline and have to add a bunch of VFX, which I'm not a fan of anyway, I prefer practical effects. I do think they have their purpose, especially when they're used correctly, especially in conjunction with real effects, like compositing real effects with visual effects do work. It does. People just don't realize it. Like they complain about the things they notice that look fake. But a lot of times there's so much going on in a frame that people don't realize what's going on. They don't realize there was visual effects added because it was done well, you know, but I didn't want to right. incorporate that in this. And I also didn't want to wait for more time and more money on the back end to get it finished. So all practical effects, barring some weird mistake or mishap that we have to clean up, which happens.
Very, very cool. So when will you announce more of the cast that has yet to be announced? Are there some bigger names or
it's a lot of local people that I've worked with before. So a lot of the larger cast has been announced. Unless we go over our budget as far as the Indiegogo, and then in that case I'd be more than happy. There's a couple people I would love to reach out to, but with regards to funding, I can't reach out to someone if we don't have a guaranteed amount that I can approach them with, you know?
Right.
It's one of those things. There's definitely a few people that I have contact information for, and I'm ready if we do go over enough that it'd be awesome to have them involved, but I haven't reached out to them yet. One thing real quick I wanted to mention about Felissa, and I'm not throwing shade to any other production, I promise, but something she said she was super excited about when I spoke to her was that a lot of times when she's called in for like, you know, because a lot of times people like Felissa Rose are called in for a couple days to do a couple days, and it's usually just her and one other actor. And the reason for that is it can be very contained. It can be, there's less concern about making the budget or making the time, you know, getting everything shot during that time when it's just her and one other actor or her and two other actors. She instantly told me how much she loved and appreciated that she gets to interact with so many other characters in this story. And she's playing an ex porn star who is now turned a producer for pornos, you know? So like she helps to fund them and their production, and she shows up and things don't go so well necessarily for her either. But, but yeah, it's awesome that she gets to interact with so many other characters. And she actually pointed that out. I didn't even really consider that. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, oh yeah, I guess that is a thing. Often when bigger names are called into indie productions, they only interact with one or two characters, and then they disappear or something happens to their character. She definitely has a lot of different interactions with a lot of different characters, and that's fun. And I love that we're incorporating awesome. Her into so much of the movie, you know? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome to see that she's going to have a bigger role, because, you know, even like Terrifier 2, you know, everyone knew that she was going to be in it, but she was only in it for like very briefly. And
yeah,
I was just like, oh, man, I, you know, and even like Tamara Glynn from Halloween.
Yeah.
Five.
I think
five. Yeah. You know, she was hardly in it, and I was just like, oh man, like there was some missed opportunities there. But you know, I think the film did well, obviously. But you know, when you have bigger names like that in horror films, and you know, they're like horror royalty, you would think, you know, that they would have bigger roles.
Yeah, it honestly comes down to availability and budgeting. And you know, I mean, and then also, you know, something that I think a lot of people do and their approach is to have people in so that they can market the film or that it becomes a film that can be sold. And I understand, you know, we all want to be able to be paid for the art we're creating. You know, I have a couple small businesses. I have a janitorial company. You know, my first film, I self-funded 100%. I mean, I sold everything I owned. I sold all kinds of stuff. I sold a car. I sold my old Nintendo Entertainment System with like 40 games, a bunch of rare, hard to find games. I cashed out 2/3 of my retirement to make my first film. You know, I get like bleeding for your art. You know, I completely get that. And I understand that wanting to hire a name to make a film marketable, I get the idea behind that. You know, and anyone that has an actor with a name involved, that's part of the reason, you know, that not only do they have experience and their horror royalty or their, you know, they have some sort of like weight behind their performance, but you also want them because of the marketability. You know, that's just a fact. You know, it is definitely.
Right. Right. Wow, man. This has been awesome.
Thanks.
You know, I definitely think that, you know, people that watch this video or listen to the podcast, you know, I hope they do check out the campaign because, you know, this seems like this is going to be potentially an awesome holiday themed horror film that, you know, just it looks and sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. So, you know, I think people should really consider taking a look at the campaign. And if they can donate towards the campaign, you know, either by purchasing posters or a thank you credit or, you know, as far as going the extra mile of being like a producer.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of things. You can be a producer. You can honestly even have your art or music, featured in the film. There's all kinds of perks. There's perks where you can have a video chat with Dolly Lee, you know, like there's just all kinds of. Yeah, there's tons of different things. Go check it out. You know, I'm not going to run down every single one of them, but there's quite a few. You can be in the movie remotely, you know. There's tons of different options on there, and some of them are pretty affordable, you know. And it helps us make the movie.
Awesome. Yeah. The link to the Indiegogo will be in the description of this episode, so definitely check it out if you want to. Or, you know, even just share the link to whatever social medias or send them to your friends, you know, whatever you want to do, just spread the word on the campaign. If you, you know, can't donate, it'd be very cool.
Facebook groups are great. Gets a lot of attention. Just saying.
Well, one more question before I let you go, man. What would be considered one of your favorite Christmas horror films?
Oh, wow.
Or do you have a couple that are favorites?
You know, let me think for a second. I know it's not a conventional answer and it's not even horror per se, but one that's always, and it's going to be kind of a curveball that I'm answering with, but one that's always really just appealed to me is Scrooged. Again, it's not horror necessarily. It's like Bill Murray comedy. It does get very dark at times. Something that's kind of a guilty pleasure, which I hate that term, but I absolutely love the movie. And it's not a tone we're trying to capture, but Santa's Sleigh with Goldberg. It's so ridiculous. And it has probably one of the best openings of like a Christmas horror movie ever. I don't think it maintains that tempo or maintains that level of quality, but you know, coming in and killing Fran Drescher and killing fucking like the entire cast of like big names, you know, like James Caan, right? Am I imagining that? Oh, no, yeah. It's James Caan. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
like, like, granted, they're all dead in the first 5-10 minutes, but like, it's so fun. Even the dog, and I'm not a fan of necessarily animals being hurt in films, but somehow they make it funny. And like, you know, it's not super horror. It has some gore in it, but you know, those are the two just off the top of my head. I do like Black Christmas as far as the heaviness of it. And I just watched that for the first time, I guess just a couple months ago now. And like, that movie really impressed me with regards to how dark it was, but how, I don't know, man, it legitimately feels like the people are in danger in that film, you know, like the POV shots and just, yeah. Yeah. So Black Christmas is definitely up there. It's just a newer watch for me. So it's something that I wouldn't start off with saying was my favorite, because I like to watch movies more than once that are Christmas themed movies, or any movie, you know, if I'm going to say they're my favorite. So yeah,
for sure. For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Those are all definitely awesome picks. Yeah. I would say Black Christmas, the original one made by Bob Clark, is definitely top tier Christmas horror films for me.
I don't know how I missed it for so long, honestly. Like, when I watched it, I was like, oh my God, this is so good.
Right, right. Like, who would have thought the director of A Christmas Story would make one of the best horror Christmas films?
And I think because that was like such a big film for me growing up, I think, and I knew that it was the same director, I thought to myself, there's no way he made a horror film that I'm going to enjoy in a completely different way. And now I just feel like the biggest asshole in the world, you know, because like, an artist doesn't have to stay in one specific area to make art, you know. Like, he fucking killed it with Black Christmas. It was amazing. Yeah,
heck yeah, man. Well, James, dude, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I just want to say good luck with the campaign, and I hope you reach your goal and you know, and you make an awesome Christmas horror film.
Yeah, I feel very confident about it. We have a lot of stuff coming up, and yeah, I'm super excited, man. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, awesome, man. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, for listening and watching, and for all my links, go to linktree.com/rude horror podcast. And just thank you all for listening to the podcast and watching, and stay tuned for the next one.